You know, I have people come to me all the time because in the venue that I'm in and I deal with a lot of OEMs, they'll say, Greg, please give me an assembler overseas. And I go, okay, how many pieces we're talking about? Oh, 1,000, a month, a week? No, a year. I go, let's keep that here. You know, I mean, you know, and I said, are we ready on this? And I will tell you this, I have discouraged more customers to go offshore and keep the business here. There's a lot of business that, like I said, needs to stay here and can stay here. And just people think it's always cheap over there. It's not.
That's my guest, Greg Papandreou. We're going to discuss best practice techniques to select your circuit board vendor and techniques to buy better boards. Next on Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Mike Conrad, founder and president of Aqueous Technologies and the host of this show, Reliability Matters. When I began this podcast back in December of 2018, I had no idea how long it would last. One, two, three episodes, who knew? I'm happy to say that through your feedback, topic and guest suggestions, and positive words, we just keep producing more episodes. Thanks for the encouragement and suggestions. Please keep both coming. You can contact me at mike@mikeconrad.com, and that's Conrad with a K. This is episode 41, and I wanted to take this opportunity to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. My guest today on this episode is Greg Papandreou. Greg is the co-founder of Better Board Buying. He's worked in and with circuit board fabrication for more than 25 years. Greg, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, Greg, you are the owner of, among other things, Better Board Buying. Tell me what that means. What does a company do? And it's a very intriguing name. So tell me what the story behind Better Board Buying is.
Sure. When I first started in the industry, I was a salesman, inside sales guy, and I really liked it. And what I found as I've been in the industry for over 25 years is that the buyers themselves today, the board buyers themselves have changed. And a lot has to do with technology. A lot has to do with workforce size, where, you know, years ago, we used to have commodity teams. And you had what is known as the fab buyer, most companies. The fab buyer was responsible for anything that was three-dimensional, metal or circuit boards. But today we have program managers and things have changed. And today's program managers are just, you know, they look at a bill of materials, here's the cost, send it out. And they really don't know what they're buying, especially when it comes to the board, a custom-made item. And I notice customers are leaving a lot of money on the table, or committing their company to too many different things. So while the last few years before I ventured off on my own again, I went ahead and started saying, hey, let me show you how to do this. And that's what came up with the name Better Board Buying. So it started out where it's more educational, where I train companies, board buyers, on how to buy a circuit board properly.
So how do you monetize that information? Do people pay you to consult with them? Is that the model?
Well, yes, actually, I'm working with Eptech now, and we'll be doing more online stuff, especially in today's world now.
We're all online right now. Yeah,
we're all online right now. Where Eptech said, "Hey, we see this as there's a lack of education out there when it comes to circuit boards." And then also I'll go into companies and, basically they'll pay me for a half day or a full day. Or if they are they bring me in and they say, hey, Greg, look, which it gets really interesting is I found the buyers today, one, are not trained. The three things, either the one, they're not trained. Okay. They're just too busy. Or three, they're lazy. Well, I don't think they're really that lazy because I think a lot of people out there are very busy and a lot of people out there are not trained to what they're doing. And so sometimes when I go in there, I'll waive the cost because they'll say, Greg, can you handle this? I say, okay, well, I'll build this board for you. I'll waive the cost. I have a customer now and I'm getting them something at a better price, but now they're going into it with a much more of a of a open mind as far as what they need to do with their circuit boards. So monetarily, it is interesting. Yes, I go in with first with, here's what it costs. I'm being very upfront, being very objective in how to help your company. And then later they'll come to me and say, you know what, Greg, this is all great. We learned a lot. Now we need your help. And that's where I become subjective. Oh, so it's kind of a little bit of a twofold approach.
Yeah. It sounds like that. One could lead, one successful customer experience could lead to a second with the same customer, telling them all the tips and tricks to buy boards and then offering to do it for them. Or they can take that knowledge and go out on their own and just use the same shops they were using before. I guess either way.
Well, actually, and there's a third way that turned out into it, because what I'm showing is customers is, you know, I was one of the first to really do big time in 2002 when I started Bear Board Group, BBG, and I sold it in 2012. We really pioneered a lot there as far as with circuit boards and brokering. Yes, it's okay. You can use the B word with me. I have no problem being called a broker. But, you know, we did a lot with that where we were doing a lot of high mix, low medium volume. We had people on the ground there at the factories inspecting, where a lot of people, they didn't have that as yet. You know, people still today will bring in boards here in the U.S. and say they're inspecting boards and then ship off to you, but they just rebox and all that. So what we started back in 2002 was something completely different. And now, 2020, what I'm finding is that model has changed, because when I was first over there, I felt that there was still a communication problem. I still felt that there was some misunderstanding of what was expected of what kind of service to give to U.S. customers. Well, you know what? Overseas, whether it be Taiwan and China, they really do know what is involved. It's not their first rodeo now with boards.
Sure.
And so I was showing, well, here's another way to, for lack of a word, bypass the broker, because a lot of times here, I'm finding that customers, when I got back into the industry, I was finding that customers are paying premium for boards that they shouldn't have. And not only leaving money on the table, but forking it over on something that's pretty benign information, that someone's just relaying information. Sure, you need someone in between. But what happened was, I said, well, let's break this down even further. Let's get closer to the factory. And that's where I noticed, you know, there are a lot of circuit board houses out there or assemblers who they'll offshore some of their engineering costs. And for lack of a better word, what I did is I said, okay, well, they offshore their engineering, and for a flat fee, whether it's one job or 20 jobs, still the same amount of money. I said, well, what if we did the same thing with boards? So we created what is known as PCB office. And what I do is what we go to a customer and say, look, pay a flat fee, cover the cost of my employee, which is now your employee, who's on the ground over there, that is responsible solely to you, and you could pay the board house direct. So basically what becomes is, you know, I'm an Uber rep. You know, I make money the old fashioned way. But now, instead of paying that 20 to 40% in costs for just relaying benign information, just cover the cost of my employee. Now it becomes your employee. And then go from there, where you could actually deal directly with the board house, copy my person, make sure that everything's done. Because you still need someone on the ground, someone with the best interest. So what happened was, what was really interesting is that when I deal with a lot of OEMs and they like the idea. In fact, one OEM, two of them actually said, hey, Greg, can we hire one of your people to watch over our complete manufacturing facility over there, trust but verify? And they've actually done that. So they've hired people, and we brought people on within our company to watch over their operation. We have customers who say, Greg, there's no need for us to spend all this money to go over and validate our check on our vendors overseas, because yes, what happens is they'll send their three top guys over there, and they go for a week, and they'll spend all this money, and they're only over there for 1 week. And sometimes they really don't know what they're looking for or looking at, or they miss. And so you take all this time and money, and you could go anywhere from $40,000 to $50,000 for a company a year to spend on to inspect their vendors. And I'm saying, you know, for a fraction of that price, you could have one of my employees 24/7 and keep on top of things. And now with the virus thing.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I want to get this question in before I forget it. This is going to sound like a provocative question, maybe even argumentative, but I don't mean it to be. This is just something I know that will be going through the head of my audience, and it's going through my head. So the reason to spend all the money to go verify a process, the reason to hire one of your employees to work in the factory, is all that extra investment and all that extra due diligence worth it if there is a comparable company here, you know, because we're both in the U.S., I'll say the U.S., maybe the
sure.
Europe, you know, we don't have to hire, we don't think about hiring outside employees to watch over a process when things are made down the road. But we do think of it when they're made thousands of miles away. Is there another way to do it? Is even with the investment of one of your employees in a shop in China or spending all this money going back and forth, 50,000, you said, you know, going back and forth to validate a process so far away. Is it still economically viable, even after all those extra investments, to build overseas versus
yes
local?
And no. Yes and no. And that's a very good question. Yes, it depends upon what it really comes down to is the volume of product. And you know, I have people come to me all the time because in the venue that I'm in and I deal with a lot of OEMs, they'll say, Greg, please get me an assembler overseas. And I go, okay, how many pieces we're talking about? Oh, 1,000, a month, a week? No, a year. I go, let's keep that here.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, you know, and I said, are we ready on this? And I will tell you this, I have discouraged more customers to go offshore than to stay on. I mean, I've discouraged more customers from going offshore to keep the business here. I mean, it's twofold. One, I mean, the businessman in me says, go wherever you can get. But also, I'm very patriotic. And third is like, for lack of a better word, what is the least resistance? Because there's some business, there's a lot of business over there even right now that doesn't belong over there. And people are banging their heads against it. And that's when they go ahead and they spend that 50 grand because they send three people over there. I said, you just lost all your savings. You know, you sent three key employees who are not in the factory, not in your office right now, 10 days, you know, oh, they have to fly business for first class, you know, and, you know, it's like, there's 50 grand. That money comes out of your bottom line, guys. Why are you doing this? So at the same time, there's a lot of stuff that stays here that needs to stay here. And some places are extremely competitive that people don't look at the total cost of ownership. And that's one thing that I really drill in because you don't want to worry about it. You're late. You know, one air shipment screws the whole thing up for profit. So there's a lot of business that, like I said, needs to stay here and can stay here. And just people think it's always cheap over there. It's not. Look, I've made a lot of money, you know, and helped a lot of customers with China, with Asian manufacture, whether it be China or Taiwan. But there are a lot of things that I'm just surprised that are over there, and they really shouldn't be over here. So the short answer, that was a long answer, but the short answer is, yeah, there's a lot of things that needs to be, that can be stayed here very easily. And you know, and 10,000 pieces is not a lot. You know, people think, oh, 10,000 pieces. Well, how big is it? You know, is it as big as your thumbnail? Or we're talking as big as your desk, you know?
As big as your thumbnail, 10,000 pieces is you know, five boards that all have, you know, breakaways on it, right?
So yeah, and then, you know, and oh, you only want deliveries once a month. Okay, well, great. Right. We'll spend that much money on freight alone.
Sure.
You know, so, you know, oh, and oh, you want to pull something in? Well, you know, so no, there's definitely. So like I said, even though we're a big, strong thing, I always tell people, I know how to sell for offshore very well. I also know how to sell against it very well. So when I get a lot of OEMs coming to me, hey, Greg, where do you want to source this? I say, I got three places. Do you want them locally to you? No, we're thinking offshore. I go, no, I think you want to keep this local to you.
Right.
Because if they're heavily engineering If they're heavily engineer minded, if there's going to be a rev change, keep it here.
Sure.
You know, if you got something, you know, that's tens of thousands of pieces and it's, you know, you're not going to have next rev, yeah, send that offshore. That makes sense. But a lot of business needs to stay here. And that's why we have more contract assemblers here in the country than we do board houses.
Let's talk about value added for a second. In addition to paying a certain amount of money and getting a certain amount of boards in a certain amount of days, you know, that's the commodity portion of boards. And I think too many assemblers view circuit board fabrication as just a commodity, right? And I have an example of that. We just released a webinar yesterday. This will be a few weeks from now, a few weeks ago by the time our listeners hear this, called SMT Wars. We do it every year. And listeners to this show will recall the story. I was hired as an expert witness when the relationship between an OEM and their contract manufacturer all fell apart when the boards started failing in very large numbers. And the problem was CAF, conductive anodic filamentation, which is a kind of a subterranean electrochemical migration issue.
Sure.
And yeah, as a board fabricator, you'd be very familiar with that. So when we went through the discovery process during the lawsuit discovery phase and we're subpoenaing all this stuff and we're going through all their emails and specifications, we saw the specification for the board material. The OEM gave the contract manufacturer the responsibility to select the boards and bring the boards to the U.S. for manufacturing. They had the boards made in China, this is not a China statement at all. I'm just stating.
Sure.
They had the boards made there. And the specification to the CM from the OEM was, and I quote, "down and dirty FR4, nothing special." It's my favorite definition of a board material. And that was actually in the specification, "down and dirty FR4, nothing special," which that statement alone swayed the outcome of the lawsuit because that just showed the OEM's intent. Like, hey, we don't really care. It's just price. Had they, you know, realized at the time that these boards are going to be potted, these boards are going to be put into the ground, these boards are going to have to survive for at least 10 years because they're backed by a battery that's supposed to last 10 years and it cannot fail because it's a critical infrastructure kind of thing. Maybe someone would have said, hey, why don't we look at CAF-resistant board materials? Because there are some. Or why don't we look at a different laminate set or whatever? And none of those questions were asked by the CM, and none of the questions were asked by whoever made the boards. So how can a board fabricator be useful to an assembler? What kind of questions should an assembler be asking a board fabricator, or maybe even more importantly, what kind of questions should a board fabricator be asking an assembler when they get a down and dirty FR4, nothing special request?
Oh, well, no, great question. Okay, and this is what it came into a training, and I'll get back to asking some questions here. What I found out is not only buyers don't know about boards, but a lot of circuit board salespeople don't know about boards themselves, or they don't even they don't ask. Not only do I, I come from unique, perspective because yes, I show people how to buy circuit boards. You know, being a broker of a $30 million company, not only did I have to sell those boards, but I had to buy them as well. So I play both sides, and I had a lot of customers say, "Greg, we've never had anyone ask us about what this goes into. Why is that?" And I said, "Well, I think it's neat to know." And I think we got to a point now where it's treated so much like a commodity that from program managers being so busy to no one's understanding the needs of the customer from the OEM, a program manager the program manager of the contract manufacturer of the customer, nor is the board house taking it one step further. What is this going into? I mean, I always look at the bottom right for a couple of reasons on the print. I want to make sure it's not ITAR or EAR because I don't want anything going offshore that shouldn't go offshore. Okay. Second, what's in that company? And I'll get an idea of what. So from a fabricator standpoint, you don't want to put yourself in a situation where You should be asking questions. I'm a firm believer in that. You need to make the, taken from a sale, I would say you need to make the ask before you make the sale. Okay. You know, Mr. Customer, you buy boards. Yes. What kind of boards do you buy? What is the technology? Who are your customers? What is this going into? Okay. Because for lack of a better word, you know, you actually want to prevent having something happen down the line from asking a simple question. In fact, in some of my training, I even talked to customers and I said, do you have a problem resolution program in place before we start doing business? Because usually, you know, when you go through the qualification process of getting on board and getting on a customer's ADL and finally get a board, no one, you know, they want to know, what's your UL, your ISO, this, that, references, finances, the whole nine yards. But no one asks about, okay, something's going to happen. We know it. We don't know when. But do we have a problem resolution program in place? And this, you know, this is part of the problem resolution program where you ask these questions. What is this going into? Is this a down and dirty FR4? It really doesn't matter, Greg. This product's okay. Okay, fine. Okay, but look, I see it says power supplies on here. Okay, but should this be a different kind of material? Should this have more copper? You know, is this okay? And, you know, a lot of good board houses out there and a lot of good salesmen out there, look, we've been around the block enough to know to ask these questions. Because unfortunately, it begins with the vendor, for lack of a better word. I mean, go with the lowest common denominator, because a lot of the program managers I'm dealing with today, and don't think this is not as an insult. I'm glad to see there's young people in there, but a lot of the people I'm dealing with today, I can be their dad, you know, and they don't know. They don't know what a D-size print is. Okay. They've never seen a silver before. Okay. You know, which things that we did, you know, they don't realize that cut and paste step repeat was done by hand manually. And even with those boards that were as big as your thumbnail, was done by great people in the art department of board houses just some 20 years ago, you know.
Sure.
And, you know, so they don't understand what goes into making a board. And so I think that's the questions we need to be asking. And it really starts at the board house. Now, it would be nice if the program manager we're dealing with knows what to do and have that. But in that case, that starts from a quality side at the OEM or the contract manufacturers. Okay, look, we don't want to have this problem. We don't want to have a piston match later on because we're talking about, you know, maybe anywhere from 5 cents to a dollar on a board. Because, you know, I've been to some places where they're just so concerned about quality that I remember one major contract manufacturer, great company, but they would stop an order on the floor because, during income inspection, and there was something that didn't quite actually make print, or they were looking at it with a 100x microscope, and they'd stop the order. And so I said to the owner of the company, look, you have to have someone make a call on this because this is a non-issue. And he said to me, Greg, well, look, I don't want this $8 an hour employee releasing a job and cost me tens of thousands of dollars. And I said, well, yes, he did. And he said, what do you mean? Because this was a non-issue because lack of training, or you didn't have someone to make that call because that $8 an hour employee kept you from making your month because you could have shipped this out and made your month and your customer would have been happy. So I know it really has to start with the manufacturer understanding the customer, the rep understanding the customer to provide that value add to say, hey, look, we're going to go this, this, and this. Will this be fine? Even another example I've done with a very large customer that built a board domestically, and they never thought about, hey, we need to look into materials that are not going to be available overseas because this is a very big runner and it needs to go offshore. And so when they brought me in and they said to me, Greg, we need this, this, this. I said, why did you pick the most expensive materials to use? And, well, this is what was available. And I said, well, you did it the wrong way. They should have been saying, where's this going? Because even the domestic board house knows how large this customer is for lack of a better word, they did their customer a disservice in saying, where is this going to go in the future? Because they were no bidding the larger volume production because they just didn't have the bandwidth to do it.
Sure.
But at the same time, they spec'd in material that were the most expensive material and material that's not readily available overseas, even down to the ledge and everything else. And I said, you know, and the customer had to go through another qualification because of UL for this board to go overseas. So that would have been helping the board house say, hey, look, is this just a one-time one-off? Are we done? You know, or is this saying, where's this going? You know, and that kind of education now could go back to the OEM and say, hey, look, hey, this is going to go to a large volume here. You know, let's design the array this way for volume. That's what we're going to do it. Let's get the materials that are easily or readily available overseas so we don't have to requalify. And so it goes both ways. But I do believe it starts with customer knowledge at the fabricator level to give that value add.
Very good. So I'm a customer. I don't know who you are, Greg. So I'm ignorant of all your advice, and I'm now going to search for a contract board fabricator anywhere in the world. Doesn't matter. What do I have to watch out for? What are the pitfalls if I don't know what I'm doing? How can I be conned? Or what are the unscrupulous fabricators doing that lands on assemblers? What do I have to watch out for?
Well, first and foremost, as I said, either they're not trained, they're too busy because they're buying everything in the organization, even down to toilet paper, which if they could find it today, anyway, or they're lazy. And like I said, I think it's the first two. That it's not because they're lazy. I think it's the first thing, they're not trained or whatever.
Okay, they're not trained, they're lazy, they're just going after the lowest price, but what should they be looking for?
Right, so what I usually do is say, before you just go through the qualification process, board house, and if there's something that you like, whatever, is, you know, okay, you establish there's someone, you establish, I like this guy's pricing, there's something interesting about him, I want to take the next level, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so anyway, so basically this is the biggest thing that people overlook, okay? References. I kid you not. I always ask, before you start dealing with them, you know, did you ask for references? No, Greg, you did not. The price was great. Well, price is good, don't get me wrong. With all things being equal, price is important, but you got to look at, you know, quality. Have you checked up on references of these people? And references is the biggest thing. And I say, ask for five. And if you can't get five quick references, that sales rep or that guy's not references of customers, that he can then move on. And that's the first thing. That's the first easiest thing before we get into anything being unscrupulous and all that. The next thing is to get a statement where, you know, depending on your product, you know, unless you are in the down and dirty, you don't care where they're going. If it's a domestic board house, you're saying, look, I'm dealing with you because you're domestic. Okay. Everything's going to be built here in the U.S. You can have them sign a document on that. You know, between the NDAs to even to the point of where I was saying before as the control is the problem resolution, the expectation, and having and it's a written agreement, you have to understand that if there is a problem, okay, I'm going to come to you, Mr. Board House, with a problem. I'm going to give you the part number, the PO number, the date code, and how many pieces affected. Okay, and I expect to have within a reasonable amount of time a response. So we've worked this out. Another thing that you can have with a board house as well, besides the offshoring, what the process in place, you know, besides good terms, you know, are they, when dealing with the board house, what are the materials they're using? In other words, if I start with this material, we're going to stay with this material. And if you do offshore, it stays the same material. And if you use an offshore house, okay, does it stay at that same offshore board house? Okay, because you're doing a value add, because, you know, even with the brokers, there's a lot of circuit board houses in this country that are brokering. They're complementing or supplementing their manufacturing. So that's another thing that gets in later on. How many circuit boards do we actually produce in this nation, as opposed to what we produce plus what board houses broke at the same time? So you want to make sure that they're not moving boards or moving product around, just save a nickel. The other thing is, right now, what I see is the biggest unscrupulous thing right now going on is the tariffs. Board houses right now, you know, even with a broker or a board house is brokering, is they're bringing boards in, and the tariff is only the amount is only taxed or tariffed on the amount of the board at time of export. So what's happening is some board houses say they buy a board for, you know, they sell you a board for a dollar. They're putting the 25% tax on the dollar. Okay, now that dollar includes their profit, the freight, their overhead. Well, that's unscrupulous. They're profiting off of that from you. And then you have other board houses out there who, or brokers who are doing this, where they're, you know, it's a fraction of the price. It's not 25%. They're basing off some number, but they're actually buying they're discounting the boards, you know, saying the board would say it was 80 cents before the tariff. Now it's 40 cents, and the other 40 cents is tooling. Well, that's actually defrauding the government. They can come after, the government can actually go downstream and come after the final customer for those tariffs. I think what would be very good between the problem resolution agreement is also having what is a hold harmless agreement in place with the board house, that they are doing what they say they're going to be doing. And if they move a job to another vendor because you have something you owe and you don't know, if they were, you know, playing, you know, loose with the tariffs that are due, and the, you know, the IRS comes knocking on your door, or the CBP comes knocking on your door, they want back taxes, you say, look, I have this agreement, you go to go back to the board house for that. That is something that would not be a bad idea to have. As far as unscrupulous, there's not, I think another way to keep a board house from being not so much unscrupulous, but keeping their pricing in check. I believe in loyalty. I do believe in loyalty with your vendor. But at the same time, the loyalty has to go both ways. And sometimes a vendor gets too comfortable. You get too comfortable with them, and you're just quoting them, and you're quoting them only. It's okay to play the field. I joke about it. Love may be blind, but blindness, but buying a circuit board doesn't have to be. Mm-hmm. You can go ahead and you could be a polygamist. You let your vendor know you're playing the field. Let them know that you're going to be watching their pricing, and let them know they're going to be exercised. And that's, it's not being unscrupulous because in the sense of their price is going up, but I think as a board buyer, you need to make sure you are getting the best price. It doesn't mean you're going to move business away, but hey, you know, you're going to be giving me the best price possible. And we're not talking a few cents here. You know, you could have this new guy come in at a, you know, a dollar, and you're getting it from $1.05 from your present vendor, and you're happy. Well, that's one thing. But if the new guy comes in and he's at 65 cents all day long, and we're comparing apples to apples, well, hey, your partner there is taking advantage of you. It is a marriage of some sort, and you just don't want to be taken advantage of. So that's where I see the most unscrupulous behavior, is where, you know, the prices creep up. And I understand business. I understand profit. But it has to be reasonable.
One thing that strikes me so much with this industry, perhaps more than any other industry, is the race to the bottom in terms of price. You know, we
live
in a world where the products we build, the electronic products that we build, are pretty much year over year required to last twice as long, be half the size, cost half as much, year over year over year over year. And you know, every year is a divide by two, divide by two, divide by two. And I think society in general has lost sense of value, right? So tell me, in the world of printed circuit fabrication, printed circuit board fabrication, what do you tell your customers with regard to price versus value? What, you know, it's never just price. I have this kind of, you know, I've run a business for almost 30 years, and
sure,
and I have this habit of, everyone thinks I'm a little crazy, I'll put stuff out for bid, and I'll generally throw out the low and throw out the high, and then just start vetting the ones somewhere in the middle. And And, you know, I might be leaving money on the table. I don't know. But to me, it's not about price. It's about value, the best value. So tell me how, in your world, how the factories that are building these boards anywhere in the world can increase value and sell that value as value added and get away from just the pennies.
Right. Well, great question. And it's true. People would say to me, Greg, you're not the cheapest here. And I go, yeah, I know. And they said, and what I tell them is this, and what any good board house should tell them, and it's really interesting, is I don't think what your method of throwing out the highest price and lowest and going for the middle or the going for the meat of it, you're not necessarily leaving money on the table at all. What I find is, you're absolutely right, is I've had people say, Greg, you know, this guy here, they're going absolutely direct to the board house, that price there. And what I would say to them is, what happens when there's a problem? A corrective action report. What do you do when there's a problem? And he says, well, we'll get quality involved. We'll get everyone to find out what's going on. No, I said, what are you going to do if there is a problem? I said, because good luck with that price. You're not going to get that price. Well, Greg, that's the quote. I said, may get the price, but you're not going to get the boards or that product. And that's today. What about tomorrow? I mean, there's a consistency, that you get with, you can go lowest price, but, that's the down and dirty. Those are the ones that I say, look, I wish the best of luck. So what you suggested, I hardly agree. I've never been the lowest price because there is a cost for the value add. There's a cost for that insurance that when a Friday night, when you have a problem at 5 o'clock and you call me or you call your vendor, hopefully by Monday morning, they have resolved. But a lot of people are not taking calls on Friday afternoon at 5:30. Unfortunately, both domestic and offshore these days. I find a big lacking in that. But that's the real concern. If you're buying on price on a custom-made item, I've got a real concern with that. The PCB represents 8 to 12% of the bill of material, the foundation of a customer's product. This custom-made item has over 100 different processes. Okay, it can come from anywhere in the world. And if you want to go the cheapest, God bless. And if, because, I can buy a capacitor, there could be a capacitor or there could be some other component. I could use that on 5 different boards that I'm building. It's interchangeable, but the board is not. I remember when I first started opening up my company and I had a warehouse, my dad said, do you have an alarm system? I said, no. Well, shouldn't you have it? You got a lot of product here. I said, Dad, there's only one person that can use that box of boards. If it's stolen, I know who grabbed it.
Right.
So, it's a custom made item. And yet there are those who go for the cheapest, who have understanding. And maybe it's ruthless. Maybe it's automotive. Maybe it's what it may be. But from the day-to-day contract manufacturer, there is value to that peace of mind because, like I said before, I've lost a job where a customer says, Greg, you're 20 cents off, 1,000 pieces. Okay. All right. It's $200. He said, yeah, Greg, you were just too much. How much was off? 20 cents, $200. Okay. So what happened was I said, well, good luck in getting those boards. Sure. You know what? He calls me and says, Greg, I need to get these boards in. What happened? And he said, they didn't come in. They're not going to be here for another 10 days.
Because someone was willing to spend 20 cents more and he got bumped probably, right?
Right. Well, that's just it. Well, correct. And that's just it where I said, well, $200 seems pretty cheap. You would have made your month. So, I think there's a lot of that. And that's where, some of that thought process, because people don't realize, they go circuit board. Even today's reps now, they don't want to contract, manufacturer's reps, they don't want to sell a circuit board because they don't understand it. And it's like, there's a lot of money to be made in this custom-made item and the value you give to your customer. You sell everything else that goes on that board. Why not sell the board itself? And there's the value, but people are missing out on it.
So Greg Papandreou, thank you for being my guest today. Your information is quite valuable. I know my audience will have quite a few takeaways from it. Your website is boardbind.com. And how do people get a hold of you if they want to tap you for some services?
Sure. Greg at boardbind.com, or my phone number is 727-480-7045. I can be reached anywhere. I'm on LinkedIn as well. Please check me out there. I do have a YouTube channel, Better Board Buying, and you can see me talk about some things about how to buy a board better, smart snippets, two-minute snippets about board buying itself, and I come out and train, or I can help you source boards better, whether you use me or not. That's part of my job.
Excellent. I will, for our audience's benefit, I'll make sure that all that information and links are in the show notes. So go to the main Spreaker.com website where this show is hosted, and you'll be able to view the show notes right there. Greg, normally I would ask you, where are you going to be in the next few months? But I think I already know the answer. Amid COVID-19, you'll probably be home.
Yes, I will be home. My wife's used to me traveling a lot.
So is mine. Yeah, so is mine. Greg Papandreou, thank you so much for being my guest today. I really appreciate it.
I enjoyed being here.
Well, that's another episode. Thanks for joining me. If you like what you hear, be sure and press the subscribe button so you'll be notified every time a new episode is available. Please continue to send your comments and suggestions. You can reach me at mike@mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and most anywhere you get your podcasts. A special thanks to the folks at Ascendo Reliability and Circuits Assembly's PCB Chat, both whom syndicate this and other podcasts at reliability.fm and pcbchat.com.
Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Join us on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for new episodes of Reliability Matters.